polls. I again told Dolores, Sir Horace noted in a Foreign Office memorandum, to shut up, but as he did not, I put down the receiver. Wilson reported this indiscretion, committed in the very office of His Majesty's Ambassador in Berlin, to his superiors. At 1 p.m., less than an hour later, Halifax wired Henderson in code. You really must be careful of use of telephone. D's conversation, Dolores was always referred to in the messages between the Foreign Office and the Berlin Embassy as D, at midday from embassy was most indiscreet and has certainly been heard by the Germans. The Last Day of Peace. Having got the Germans and Poles to agree to direct negotiations, as they thought, the British and French governments, though highly skeptical of Hitler, had concentrated their efforts on trying to bring such talks about. In this, Britain took the lead, supported diplomatically in Berlin and especially in Warsaw by France. Although the British did not advise the Poles to accept Hitler's ultimatum and fetch an emissary with full powers to Berlin on August 30th, holding that such a demand was, as Halifax had wired Henderson, wholly unreasonable, they did urge Colonel Beck to declare that he was prepared to negotiate with Berlin without delay. This was the substance of a message which Halifax got off to his ambassador in Warsaw late on the night of August 30th. Kennard was to inform Beck of the contents of the British note to Germany, which Henderson was presenting to Ribbentrop, assure him that Britain would stand by its commitments to Poland, but stress the importance of Poland's agreeing to direct discussions with Germany at once. We regard it as most important, Halifax telegraphed, from the point of view of the internal situation in Germany and of world opinion, that so long as the German government profess themselves ready to negotiate, no opportunity should be given them for placing the blame for a conflict on Poland. Kennard saw Beck at midnight, and the Polish foreign minister promised to consult his government and give him a considered reply by midday on August 31st. Kennard's dispatch describing this interview reached the British Foreign Office at 8 a.m., and Halifax was not entirely satisfied with it. At noon, it was now the last day of August, he wired Kennard that he should concert with his French colleague in Warsaw, Léon Noël, the French ambassador, and suggest to the Polish government that they should now make known to the German government, preferably direct, but if not through us, that they have been made aware of our last reply to German government and that they confirm their acceptance of the principle of direct discussions. French government fear that German government might take advantage of silence on part of Polish government. Lord Halifax was still uneasy about his Polish allies, and less than 2 hours later at 1:45 p.m., he again wired Kennard. Please at once inform Polish government and advise them, in view of fact that they have accepted principle of direct discussions, immediately to instruct Polish ambassador in Berlin to say to German government that, if latter have any proposals, he is ready to transmit them to his government so that they may at once consider them and make suggestions for early discussions. But shortly before this telegram was dispatched, Beck, in response to the démarche of the midnight before, had already informed the British ambassador in a written note that the Polish government confirmed their readiness for a direct exchange of views with the German government, and had orally assured him that he was instructing Lipsky to seek an interview with Ribbentrop to say that Poland had accepted the British proposals. When Kennard asked Beck what Lipsky would do if Ribbentrop handed over the German proposals, the foreign minister replied that his ambassador in Berlin would not be authorized to accept them, as, in view of past experience, it might be accompanied by some sort of an ultimatum. The important thing, said Beck, was to re-establish contact, and then details should be discussed as to where, with whom, and on what basis negotiations should be commenced. In the light of the past experience which the once pro-Nazi Polish foreign minister mentioned, this was not an unreasonable view. Beck added, Kennard wired London, that if invited to go to Berlin, he would of course not go, as he had no intention of being treated like President Hacha. Actually, Beck did not send to Lipsky quite those instructions. Instead of saying that Poland accepted the British proposals, Lipsky was told to tell the Germans that Poland was favorably considering the British suggestions and would make a formal reply during the next few hours at the latest. There was more to Beck's instructions to Lipsky than that, and the Germans, having solved the Polish ciphers, knew it. For a simple and good reason that will soon become apparent, the Germans were not anxious to receive the Polish ambassador in Berlin. It was too late. At 1 p.m., a few minutes after he had received his telegraphic instructions from Warsaw, Lipsky requested an interview with Ribbentrop for the purpose of presenting a communication from his government. After cooling his heels for a couple of hours, he received a telephone call from Weizsäcker asking, on behalf of the German foreign minister, whether he was coming as an emissary with full power or in some other capacity. "I replied," Lipsky reported later in his final report, "that I was asking for an interview as ambassador to present a declaration from my government." Another long wait followed. At 5 p.m., Atolico called on Ribbentrop and communicated the urgent desire of the Duce that the Führer should receive Lipsky to establish in this way at least the minimum contact necessary for the avoidance of a final breach. The German foreign minister promised to transmit the Duce's wishes to the Führer. This was not the first call the Italian ambassador had made in the Wilhelmstrasse on this last day of August in order to try to save the peace. At 9 that morning, Atolico had advised Rome that the situation was desperate, and that unless something new comes up, there will be war in a few hours. In Rome, Mussolini and Ciano put their heads together to find something new. The first result was that Ciano telephoned Halifax to say that Mussolini could not intervene unless he were able to produce for Hitler a fat prize, Danzig. The British Foreign Secretary did not rise to the bait. He told Ciano the first thing to be done was to establish direct contact between the Germans and the Poles, through Lipsky. Thus, at 11:30 a.m., Atolico saw Weizsäcker at the German Foreign Office and apprised him that Mussolini was in contact with London, and it suggested the return of Danzig as a first step toward a German-Polish settlement, and that the Duce needed a certain margin of time to perfect his plan for peace. In the meantime, couldn't the German government receive Lipsky? Lipsky was received by Ribbentrop at 6:15 p.m., more than 5 hours after he had requested the interview. It did not last long. The ambassador, despite his fatigue and his worn nerves, behaved with dignity. He read to the Nazi foreign minister a written communication. "Last night the Polish government were informed by the British government of an exchange of views with the Reich government as to a possibility of direct negotiations between the Polish and German governments. The Polish government are favorably considering the British government's suggestion and will make them a formal reply on the subject during the next few hours." "I added," said Lipsky later, "that I had been trying to present this declaration since 1 p.m. When Ribbentrop asked him whether he had come as an emissary empowered to negotiate, the ambassador replied that, for the time being, he had only been instructed to remit the communication which he had just read, whereupon he handed it to the foreign minister. He had expected, Ribbentrop said, that Lipsky would come as a fully empowered delegate, and when the ambassador again declared that he had no such role, he was dismissed. Ribbentrop said he would inform the Führer. On my return to the embassy," Lipsky later related, "I found myself unable to communicate with Warsaw as the Germans had cut my telephone." The questions of Weizsäcker and Ribbentrop as to the ambassador's status as a negotiator were purely formal, with an eye, no doubt, for the record, for ever since noon, when Lipsky's communication had been received by telegram from Warsaw, the Germans had known that he was not coming, as they had demanded, as a plenipotentiary. They had decoded the telegram immediately. A copy had been sent to Goering, who showed it to Dolores and instructed him to take it post-haste to Henderson, so that the British government, as the Field Marshal later explained on the stand at Nuremberg, should find out as quickly as possible how intransigent the Polish attitude was. Goering read to the tribunal the secret instructions to Lipsky, which were that the ambassador should refrain from conducting official negotiations under any circumstances, and should insist that he had no plenipotentiary powers, and that he was merely empowered to deliver the official communication of his government. In his testimony, the Field Marshal made much of this during his vain effort to convince the Nuremberg judges that Poland had sabotaged Hitler's last bid for peace, and that, as he said, he, Goering, did not want war and had done everything he could to prevent it. But Goering's veracity was only a shade above Ribbentrop's, and one example of this was his further assertion to the court that only after Lipsky's visit to the Wilhelmstrasse at 6:15 p.m. on August 31st did Hitler decide on invasion the next day. The truth was quite otherwise. In fact, all these scrambling 11th-hour moves of the weary and exhausted diplomats, and of the overwrought men who directed them on the afternoon and evening of that last day of August 1939, were but a flailing of the air, completely futile, and in the case of the Germans, entirely and purposely deceptive. For at half-afternoon on August 31st, before Lord Halifax had urged the Poles to be more accommodating, and before Lipski had called on Ribbentrop, and before the Germans had made publicly known their generous proposals to Poland, and before Mussolini had tried to intervene, Adolf Hitler had taken his final decision and issued the decisive order that was to throw the planet into its bloodiest war. Supreme Commander of the Armed Forces, Most Secret, Berlin, August 31st, 1939. Directive number 1 for the conduct of the war. 1. Now that all the political possibilities of disposing by peaceful means of a situation on the eastern frontier which is intolerable for Germany are exhausted, I have determined on a solution by force. 2. The attack on Poland is to be carried out in accordance with the preparations made for Case White, with the alterations which result, where the army is concerned, from the fact that it has in the meantime almost completed its dispositions. Allotment of tasks and the operational target remain unchanged. Date of attack, September 1, 1939. Time of attack, 4:45 a.m. Inserted in red pencil. This timing also applies to the operation at Gdynia, Bay of Danzig, and the Dirschau Bridge. 3. In the West, it is important that the responsibility for the opening of hostilities should rest squarely on England and France. For the time being, insignificant frontier violations should be met by purely local action. The neutrality of Holland, Belgium, Luxembourg, and Switzerland, to which we have given assurances, must be scrupulously observed. On land, the German western frontier is not to be crossed without my express permission. At sea, the same applies for all warlike actions or actions which could be regarded as such. A marginal note in the directive clears up this ambiguous point. Thus, Atlantic forces will, for the time being, remain in a waiting position. 4. If Britain and France open hostilities against Germany, it is the task of the Wehrmacht formations operating in the West to conserve their forces as much as possible, and thus maintain the conditions for a victorious conclusion of the operations against Poland. Within these limits, enemy forces and their military economic resources are to be damaged as much as possible. Orders to go over to the attack I reserve, in any case, to myself. The army will hold the west wall and make preparations to prevent its being outflanked in the north through violation of Belgian or Dutch territory by the western powers. The navy will carry on warfare against merchant shipping, directed mainly at England. The air force is, in the first place, to prevent the French and British air forces from attacking the German army and the German Lebensraum. In conducting the war against England, preparations are to be made for the use of the Luftwaffe in disrupting British supplies by sea, the armaments industry, and the transport of troops to France. A favorable opportunity is to be taken for an effective attack on massed British naval units, especially against battleships and aircraft carriers. Attacks against London are reserved for my decision. Preparations are to be made for attacks against the British mainland, bearing in mind that partial success with insufficient forces is in all circumstances to be avoided. Adolf Hitler. Shortly after noon on August 31st, then, Hitler formally and in writing directed the attack on Poland to begin at dawn the next day. As his first war directive indicates, he was still not quite sure what Britain and France would do. He would refrain from attacking them first. If they took hostile action, he was prepared to meet it. Perhaps, as Halder had indicated in his diary entry of August 28th, the British would go through the motions of honoring their obligation to Poland and wage a sham war. If so, the Führer would not take it amiss. Probably, the Nazi dictator made his fateful decision a little earlier than 12:30 p.m. on the last day of August. At 6:40 p.m. on the previous day, Halder jotted in his diary a communication from Lieutenant Colonel Kurt Sievert, adjutant of General von Brauchitsch. Make all preparations so that attack can begin at 4:30 a.m. on September 1st. Should negotiations in London require postponement, then September 2nd. In that case, we shall be notified before 3 p.m. tomorrow. Führer, either September 1st or 2nd. All off after September 2nd. Because of the autumn rains, the attack had to begin at once or be called off altogether. Very early on the morning of August 31st, while Hitler still claimed he was waiting for the Polish emissary, the German army received its orders. At 6:30 a.m., Halder jotted down, "Word from the Reich Chancellery that jump-off order has been given for September 1st. At 11:30, General Stulpnagel reports on fixing of time of attack for 0445, 4:45 a.m. Intervention of West said to be unavoidable. In spite of this, Führer has decided to attack." An hour later, the formal Directive Number 1 was issued. There was, I remember, an eerie atmosphere that day in Berlin. Everyone seemed to be going around in a daze. At 7:25 in the morning, Weizsäcker had telephoned Ulrich von Hassel, one of the conspirators, and asked him to hurry over to see him. The State Secretary saw only one last hope, that Henderson should persuade Lipsky and his government to send a Polish plenipotentiary at once, or at least to announce the intention of dispatching one. Could the unemployed Hassel see his friend Henderson at once and also Göring to this end? Hassel tried. He saw Henderson twice and Göring once. But veteran diplomat and now anti-Nazi that he was, he did not seem to realize that events had outstripped such puny efforts. Nor did he grasp the extent of his own confusions and of those of Weizsäcker and all the good Germans who, of course, wanted peace, on German terms. For it must have been obvious to them on August 31st that there would be war, unless either Hitler or the Poles backed down, and that there was not the slightest possibility of the one or the other capitulating. And yet, as Hassel's diary entry for this day makes clear, he expected the Poles to back down and to follow the same disastrous route which the Austrians and Czechs had taken. When Henderson tried to point out to Hassel that the chief difficulty was in German methods, in the way they were trying to order the Poles around like stupid little boys, Hassel retorted that the persistent silence of the Poles was also objectionable. He added that everything depended on Lipsky putting in an appearance, not to ask questions, but to declare his willingness to negotiate. Even to Hassel, the Poles, who were threatened with imminent attack on trumped-up Nazi charges, were not supposed to ask questions. And when the former ambassador summed up his final conclusions about the outbreak of the war, though he blamed Hitler and Ribbentrop for knowingly taking the risk of war with the Western powers, he also heaped much responsibility on the Poles, and even on the British and French. "The Poles, for their part," he wrote, "with Polish conceit and Slavic aimlessness, confident of English and French support, had missed every remaining chance of avoiding war." One can only ask what chance they missed except to surrender to Hitler's full demands. "The government in London," Hassel added, "gave up the race in the very last days and adopted a kind of devil-may-care attitude. France went through the same stages, only with much more hesitation. Mussolini did all in his power to avoid war." If an educated, cultivated, and experienced diplomat such as Hassel could be so woolly in his thinking, is it any wonder that it was easy for Hitler to take in the mass of the German people? There now followed, during the waning afternoon of the last day of peace, a somewhat grotesque interlude. In view of what is now known about the decisions of the day, it might have been thought that the commander-in-chief of the Luftwaffe, which was to carry out far-flung air operations against Poland beginning at dawn on the morrow, would be a very busy field marshal. On the contrary, Dollarus took him out to lunch at the Hotel Esplanade and plied him with good food and drink. The cognac was of such high quality that Göring insisted on lugging away two bottles of it when he left. Having got the field marshal into the proper humor, Dollarus proposed that he invite Henderson for a talk. After receiving Hitler's permission, he did so, inviting him and Forbes to his house for tea at 5 p.m. Dollarus, whose presence is not mentioned by Henderson in his final report or in his book, says that he suggested that Göring, on behalf of Germany, meet a Polish emissary in Holland, and that Henderson promised to submit the proposal to London. The British ambassador's version of the tea talk, given in his final report, was that Göring talked for 2 hours of the iniquities of the Poles and about Herr Hitler's and his own desire for friendship with England. It was a conversation which led to nowhere. My general impression was that it constituted a final but forlorn effort on his part to detach Britain from the Poles. I augured the worst from the fact that he was in a position at such a moment to give me so much of his time. He could scarcely have afforded at such a moment to spare time in conversation if it did not mean that everything down to the last detail was now ready for action. The third and most piquant description of this bizarre tea party was given by Forbes in answer to a questionnaire from Goering's lawyer at Nuremberg. The atmosphere was negative and desperate, though friendly. Goering's statement to the British ambassador was, if the Poles should not give in, Germany would crush them like lice, and if Britain should decide to declare war, he would regret it greatly, but it would be most imprudent of Britain. Later in the evening, Henderson, according to his own account, drafted a dispatch to London saying that it would be quite useless for me to make any further suggestions, since they would now only be outstripped by events, and that the only course remaining to us was to show our inflexible determination to resist force by force. He may have drafted it that evening, but he did not send it to London until 3:45 p.m. the next day, nearly 12 hours after the German attack on Poland had begun. It followed several of his telegrams, which, like it, were telephoned to London, so that transmission was simultaneous, reporting the outbreak of hostilities. It read, "Mutual distrust of Germans and Poles is so complete that I do not feel I can usefully acquiesce in any further suggestions from here, which would only once again be outstripped by events or lead to nothing as the result of methods followed or of considerations of honor and prestige. Last hope lies in inflexible determination on our part to resist force by force." Sir Neville Henderson's disillusionment seemed complete. Despite all his strenuous efforts over the years to appease the insatiable Nazi dictator, his mission to Germany, as he called it, had failed. In the fading hours of August's last day, this shallow, debonair Englishman, whose personal diplomacy in Berlin had been so disastrously blind, tried to face up to the shattering collapse of his vain hopes and abortive plans. And though he would suffer one more typical, incredible lapse the next day, the first day of war, an ancient truth was dawning on him, that there were times and circumstances when, as he at last said, force must be met by force. Since friends who have read this section have expressed doubts about this writer's objectivity in dealing with Henderson, perhaps another's view of the British ambassador in Berlin should be given. Sir L. B. Namier, a British historian, has summed up Henderson as follows. Conceited, vain, self-opinionated, rigidly adhering to his preconceived ideas, he poured out telegrams, dispatches, and letters in unbelievable numbers and of formidable length, repeating 100 times the same ill-founded views and ideas. Obtuse enough to be a menace and not stupid enough to be innocuous, he proved un homme néfaste. Namier, In the Nazi Era, page 162. As darkness settled over Europe on the evening of August 31, 1939, and 1.5 million German troops began moving forward to their final positions on the Polish border for the jump-off at dawn, all that remained for Hitler to do was to perpetrate some propaganda trickery to prepare the German people for the shock of aggressive war. The people were in need of the treatment which Hitler, abetted by Goebbels and Himmler, had become so expert in applying. I had been about in the streets of Berlin, talking with the ordinary people, and that morning noted in my diary, "Everybody against the war, people talking openly. How can a country go into a major war with a population so dead against it?" Despite all my experience in the Third Reich, I asked such a naive question. Hitler knew the answer very well. Had he not the week before on his Bavarian mountaintop promised the generals that he would give a propagandist reason for starting the war, and admonished them not to mind whether it was plausible or not? "The victor," he had told them, "will not be asked afterward whether he told the truth or not. In starting and waging a war, it is not right that matters, but victory." At 9 p.m., as we have seen, all German radio stations broadcast the Führer's Polish peace proposals, which, as they were read over the air, seemed so reasonable to this misled correspondent. The fact that Hitler had never presented them to the Poles, nor even, except in a vague and unofficial manner, to the British, and then, less than 24 hours before, was brushed over. In fact, in a lengthy statement explaining to the German people how their government had exhausted every diplomatic means to preserve the peace, the Chancellor, no doubt aided by Goebbels, showed that he had lost none of his touch for masterly deceit. After the British government on August 28th, it said, had offered its mediation between Germany and Poland, the German government on the next day had replied that, in spite of being skeptical of the desire of the Polish government to come to an understanding, they declared themselves ready in the interests of peace to accept the British mediation or suggestion. They considered it necessary, if the danger of a catastrophe was to be avoided, that action must be taken readily and without delay. They declared themselves ready to receive a personage appointed by the Polish government up to the evening of August 30th, with the proviso that the latter was empowered not only to discuss, but to conduct and conclude negotiations. Instead of a statement regarding the arrival of an authorized personage, the first answer the government of the Reich received to their readiness for an understanding was the news of the Polish mobilization. The Reich government cannot be expected continually not only to emphasize their willingness to start negotiations, but actually to be ready to do so, while being from the Polish side merely put off with empty subterfuges and meaningless declarations. It has once more been made clear, as a result of a démarche which has meanwhile been made by the Polish ambassador, that the latter himself has no plenary powers either to enter into any discussion or even to negotiate. The Führer and the German government have thus waited 2 days in vain for the arrival of a Polish negotiator. In these circumstances, the German government regard their proposals as having this time too been rejected, although they considered that these proposals, in the form in which they were made known to the British government also, were more than loyal, fair, and practicable. Good propaganda, to be effective, as Hitler and Goebbels had learned from experience, needs more than words. It needs deeds, however much they may have to be fabricated. Having convinced the German people, and of this the writer can testify from personal observation, that the Poles had rejected the Führer's generous peace offer, there remained only the concocting of a deed which would prove that not Germany but Poland had attacked first. For this last shady business, it will be remembered, the Germans, at Hitler's direction, had made careful preparation. For 6 days, Alfred Naujoks, the intellectual SS ruffian, had been waiting at Gliwice on the Polish border to carry out a simulated Polish attack on the German radio station there. The plan had been revised. SS men outfitted in Polish army uniforms were to do the shooting, and drugged concentration camp inmates were to be left dying as casualties. This last delectable part of the operation had, as we have seen, the expressive codename Canned Goods. There were to be several such faked Polish attacks, but the principal one was to be on the radio station at Gliwice. At noon on August 31st, Naujoks related in his Nuremberg affidavit, I received from Heydrich the code word for the attack which was to take place at 8 o'clock that evening. Heydrich said, in order to carry out this attack, report to Müller for canned goods. I did this and gave Müller instructions to deliver the man near the radio station. I received this man and had him laid down at the entrance to the station. He was alive, but completely unconscious. I tried to open his eyes. I could not recognize by his eyes that he was alive, only by his breathing. I did not see the gun wounds, but a lot of blood was smeared across his face. He was in civilian clothes. We seized the radio station as ordered, broadcast a speech of 3 to 4 minutes over an emergency transmitter, fired some pistol shots, and left. The speech in Polish had been outlined by Heydrich to Naujoks. It contained inflammatory statements against Germany and declared that the Poles were attacking. The Polish attack at Gliwice was used by Hitler in his speech to the Reichstag the next day, and was cited as justification for the Nazi aggression by Ribbentrop, Weizsäcker, and other members of the Foreign Office in their propaganda. The New York Times and other newspapers reported it, as well as similar incidents, in their issues of September 1, 1939. It remains only to be added that according to the testimony at Nuremberg of General Lauhausen, of the Abwehr, all the SS men who wore Polish uniforms in the simulated attacks that evening were, as the general put it, put out of the way. Berlin, that evening, was largely shut off from the outside world, except for outgoing press dispatches and broadcasts which reported the Führer's offer to Poland and the German allegations of Polish attacks on German territory. I tried to get through on the telephone to Warsaw, London, and Paris, but was told that communications with these capitals were cut. Berlin itself was quite normal in appearance. There had been no evacuation of women and children, as there had been in Paris and London, nor any sandbagging of storefront windows, as was reported from the other capitals. Toward 4 a.m. on September 1st, after my last broadcast, I drove back from Broadcasting House to the Adlon Hotel. There was no traffic. The houses were dark. The people were asleep, and perhaps, for all I knew, had gone to bed hoping for the best, for peace. Hitler himself had been in fine fettle all day. At 6 p.m. on August 31st, General Halder noted in his diary, "Führer calm, has slept well. Decision against evacuation in the West shows that he expects France and England will not take action. During the day, Hitler found time to send a telegram to the Duke of Windsor at Antibes, France. Berlin, August 31, 1939. I thank you for your telegram of August 27th. You may rest assured that my attitude toward Britain and my desire to avoid another war between our peoples remain unchanged. It depends on Britain, however, whether my wishes for the future development of German-British relations can be realized. Adolf Hitler. This is the first mention of the former King of England, but by no means the last, in the captured German documents. Subsequently, for a time, as will be recorded further on, the Duke of Windsor loomed large in certain calculations of Hitler and Ribbentrop. Admiral Canaris, chief of the Abwehr in OKW and one of the key anti-Nazi conspirators, was in a different mood. Though Hitler was carrying Germany into war, an action which the Canaris circle had supposedly sworn to prevent by getting rid of the dictator, there was no conspiracy in being now that the moment for it had arrived. Later in the afternoon, Gisevius had been summoned to OKW headquarters by Colonel Oster. This nerve center of Germany's military might was humming with activity. Canaris drew Gisevius down a dimly lit corridor. In a voice choked with emotion, he said, "This means the end of Germany." Chapter 17. The Launching of World War II. At daybreak on September 1, 1939, the very date which Hitler had set in his first directive for Case White, back on April 3rd, the German armies poured across the Polish frontier and converged on Warsaw from the north, south, and west. Overhead, German warplanes roared toward their targets, Polish troop columns and ammunition dumps, bridges, railroads, and open cities. Within a few minutes, they were giving the Poles, soldiers and civilians alike, the first taste of sudden death and destruction from the skies ever experienced on any great scale on the earth, and thereby inaugurating a terror which would become dreadfully familiar to hundreds of millions of men, women, and children in Europe and Asia during the next 6 years, and whose shadow, after the nuclear bombs came, would haunt all mankind with the threat of utter extinction. It was a gray, somewhat sultry morning in Berlin, with clouds hanging low over the city, giving it some protection from hostile bombers, which were feared, but never came. The people in the streets, I noticed, were apathetic, despite the immensity of the news which had greeted them from their radios and from the extra editions of the morning newspapers. Hitler's proclamation to the army announcing the opening of hostilities was broadcast over the German radio at 5:40 a.m., and the newspaper extras were on the street shortly after. Across the street from the Adlon Hotel, the morning shift of laborers had gone to work on the new IG Farben building just as if nothing had happened, and when newsboys came by shouting their extras, no one laid down his tools to buy one. Perhaps, it occurred to me, the German people were simply dazed at waking up on this first morning of September to find themselves in a war which they had been sure the Führer somehow would avoid. They could not quite believe it now that it had come. What a contrast, one could not help thinking, between this gray apathy and the way the Germans had gone to war in 1914. Then there had been a wild enthusiasm. The crowds in the street had staged delirious demonstrations, tossed flowers at the marching troops, and frantically cheered the Kaiser and Supreme Warlord, Wilhelm II. There were no such demonstrations this time for the troops or for the Nazi warlord, who shortly before 10 a.m. drove from the Chancellery to the Reichstag through empty streets to address the nation on the momentous happenings which he himself, deliberately and cold-bloodedly, had just provoked. Even the robot members of the Reichstag, party hacks for the most part, whom Hitler had appointed, failed to respond with much enthusiasm as the dictator launched into his explanation of why Germany found itself on this morning engaged in war. There was far less cheering than on previous and less important occasions when the leader had declaimed from this tribune in the ornate hall of the Kroll Opera House. Though truculent at times, he seemed strangely on the defensive, and throughout the speech, I thought as I listened, ran a curious strain, as though he himself were dazed at the fix he had got himself into and felt a little desperate about it. His explanation of why his Italian ally had reneged on its automatic obligations to come to his aid did not seem to go over even with this hand-picked audience. I should like, he said, here above all to thank Italy, which throughout has supported us. But you will understand that for the carrying out of this struggle, we do not intend to appeal for foreign help. We will carry out this task ourselves. Having lied so often on his way to power and in his consolidation of power, Hitler could not refrain at this serious moment in history from thundering a few more lies to the gullible German people in justification of his wanton act. You know the endless attempts I made for a peaceful clarification and understanding of the problem of Austria, and later of the problem of the Sudetenland, Bohemia, and Moravia. It was all in vain. In my talks with Polish statesmen, I formulated at last the German proposals, and there is nothing more modest or loyal than these proposals. I should like to say this to the world. I alone was in the position to make such proposals, for I know very well that in doing so I brought myself into opposition to millions of Germans. These proposals have been refused. For 2 whole days I sat with my government and waited to see whether it was convenient for the Polish government to send a plenipotentiary or not. But I am wrongly judged if my love of peace and my patience are mistaken for weakness or even cowardice. I can no longer find any willingness on the part of the Polish government to conduct serious negotiations with us. I have therefore resolved to speak to Poland in the same language that Poland for months past has used toward us. This night, for the first time, Polish regular soldiers fired on our own territory. Since 5:45 a.m. we have been returning the fire, and from now on bombs will be met with bombs. Thus was the faked German attack on the German radio station at Gliwice, which, as we have seen, was carried out by SS men in Polish uniforms under the direction of Naujoks, used by the Chancellor of Germany as justification of his cold-blooded aggression against Poland. And indeed, in its first communiques, the German High Command referred to its military operations as a counterattack. Even Weizsäcker did his best to perpetrate this shabby swindle. During the day he got off a circular telegram from the Foreign Office to all German diplomatic missions abroad, advising them on the line they were to take. In defense against Polish attacks, German troops moved into action against Poland at dawn today. This action is for the present not to be described as war, but merely as engagements which have been brought about by Polish attacks. Even the German soldiers, who could see for themselves who had done the attacking on the Polish border, were bombarded with Hitler's lie. In a grandiose proclamation to the German army on September 1st, the Führer said, "The Polish state has refused the peaceful settlement of relations which I desired, and has appealed to arms. A series of violations of the frontier, intolerable to a great power, prove that Poland is no longer willing to respect the frontier of the Reich. In order to put an end to this lunacy, I have no other choice than to meet force with force from now on." Only once that day did Hitler utter the truth. "I am asking of no German man," he told the Reichstag, "more than I myself was ready throughout 4 years to do. I am from now on just the first soldier of the German Reich. I have once more put on that coat that was most sacred and dear to me. I will not take it off again until victory is secured, or I will not survive the outcome." In the end, this once, he would prove as good as his word. But no German I met in Berlin that day noticed that what the leader was saying, quite bluntly, was that he could not face, not take, defeat should it come. In his speech, Hitler named Göring as his successor, should anything happen to him. Hess, he added, would be next in line. "Should anything happen to Hess," Hitler advised, "then by law the Senate will be called and will choose from its midst the most worthy, that is to say, the bravest successor." What law? What Senate? Neither existed. Hitler's relatively subdued manner at the Reichstag gave way to another and uglier mood as soon as he had returned to the Chancellery. The ubiquitous Dollarus, in tow of Göring, found him there in an exceedingly nervous and very agitated state. "He told me," the Swedish mediator later testified, "he had all along suspected that England wanted the war. He told me further that he would crush Poland and annex the whole country. He grew more and more excited and began to wave his arms as he shouted in my face, 'If England wants to fight for a year, I shall fight for a year. If England wants to fight 2 years, I shall fight 2 years.' He paused and then yelled, his voice rising to a shrill scream and his arms milling wildly. "If England wants to fight for 3 years, I shall fight for 3 years." The movements of his body now began to follow those of his arms, and when he finally bellowed, "Und wenn es erforderlich ist, will ich 10 Jahre kämpfen," "and if necessary, I will fight for 10 years," he brandished his fist and bent down so that it nearly touched the floor. Yet, for all his hysteria, Hitler was by no means convinced that he would have to fight Great Britain at all. It was now past noon. German armored columns were already several miles inside Poland, and advancing rapidly, and most of Poland's cities, including Warsaw, had been bombed with considerable civilian casualties. But there was not a word from London or Paris that Britain and France were in any hurry to honor their word to Poland. Their course seemed clear, but Dolores and Henderson appeared to be doing their best to confuse it. At 10:30 a.m., the British ambassador telephoned a message to Halifax. "I understand," he said, "that the Poles blew up the Dirschau Bridge during the night, and that fighting took place with the Danzigers. On receipt of this news, Hitler gave orders for the Poles to be driven back from the borderline and to Göring for destruction of the Polish Air Force along the frontier." Only at the end of his dispatch did Henderson add, "This information comes from Göring himself. Hitler may ask to see me after Reichstag as a last effort to save the peace." What peace? Peace for Britain? For 6 hours, Germany had been waging war, with all its military might, against Britain's ally. The German operation to seize the Dirschau Bridge over the Vistula before the Poles could blow it up had been planned early in the summer, and appears constantly in the papers for Case White. It was specifically ordered in Hitler's Directive No. 1 on August 31st. Actually, the operation failed, partly because early morning fog hampered the dropping of paratroopers who were to seize the bridge. The Poles succeeded in blowing it up just in time. Hitler did not send for Henderson after his Reichstag speech, and the ambassador, who had accommodatingly passed along to London Göring's lies about the Poles beginning the attack, became discouraged, but not completely discouraged. At 10:50 a.m., he telephoned a further message to Halifax. A new idea had sprung up in his fertile but confused mind. "I feel it my duty," he reported, however little prospect there may be of its realization, "to express the belief that the only possible hope now for peace would be for Marshal Smigliritz to announce his readiness to come immediately to Germany, to discuss as soldier and plenipotentiary the whole question with Field Marshal Göring." It does not seem to have occurred to this singular British ambassador that Marshal Smigliritz might have his hands full trying to repel the massive and unprovoked German attack, or that if he could break off and did come to Berlin as a plenipotentiary, it would be equivalent, under the circumstances, to surrender. The Poles might be quickly beaten, but they would not surrender. Dolores was even more active than Henderson during this first day of the German attack on Poland. At 8 a.m. he had gone to see Göring, who told him that war had broken out because the Poles had attacked the radio station at Gliwice and blown up a bridge near Dirschau. The Swede immediately rang up the Foreign Office in London with the news. "I informed somebody," he later testified in cross-examination at Nuremberg, "that according to the information I had received, the Poles had attacked, and they naturally wondered what was happening to me when I gave that information." But after all, it was only what His Majesty's ambassador in Berlin would be telephoning a couple of hours later. A confidential British Foreign Office memorandum records the Swede's call at 9:05 a.m. Aping Göring, Dolores insisted to London that the Poles are sabotaging everything, and that he had evidence they never meant to attempt to negotiate. At half afternoon, Dolores was on the long-distance phone again to the Foreign Office in London, and this time got Cadogan. He again blamed the Poles for sabotaging the peace by blowing the Dirschau Bridge, and suggested that he once again fly to London with Forbes. But the stern and unappeasing Cadogan had had about enough of Dolores now that the war which he had tried to prevent had come. He told the Swede that nothing could now be done. But Cadogan was merely the permanent undersecretary for foreign affairs, not even a member of the cabinet. Dolores insisted that his request be submitted to the cabinet itself, informing Cadogan haughtily that he would ring back in an hour. This he did, and got his answer. Any idea of mediation, Cadogan said, while German troops are invading Poland is quite out of the question. The only way in which a world war can be stopped is, one, that hostilities be suspended, and two, that German troops be immediately withdrawn from Polish territory. At 10 a.m., the Polish ambassador in London, Count Raczynski, had called on Lord Halifax and officially communicated to him the news of the German aggression, adding that it was a plain case as provided for by the treaty. The foreign secretary answered that he had no doubt of the facts. At 10:50, he summoned the German chargé d'affaires, Theodor Kurt, to the foreign office and asked him if he had any information. Kurt replied that he had neither information about a German attack on Poland nor any instructions. Halifax then declared that the reports which he had received create a very serious situation. But further than that, he did not go. Kurt telephoned this information to Berlin at 11:45 a.m. By noon, then, Hitler had reason to hope that Britain, though it considered the situation serious, might not go to war after all. But the hope was soon to be dashed. At 7:15 p.m., a member of the British Embassy in Berlin telephoned the German Foreign Office and requested Ribbentrop to receive Henderson and Coulondre on a matter of urgency as soon as possible. The French embassy made a similar request a few minutes later. Ribbentrop, having declined to meet the two ambassadors together, received Henderson at 9 p.m. and Coulondre an hour later. From the British ambassador, he was handed a formal note from the British government. "Unless the German government are prepared," it said, "to give His Majesty's government satisfactory assurances that the German government have suspended all aggressive action against Poland and are prepared promptly to withdraw their forces from Polish territory, His Majesty's government will without hesitation fulfill their obligation to Poland." The French communication was in identical words. To both ambassadors, Ribbentrop replied that he would transmit their notes to Hitler, whereupon he launched into a lengthy dissertation declaring that there was no question of German aggression, but of Polish aggression, and repeated the by now somewhat stale lie that regular Polish troops had attacked German soil on the previous day. Still, the diplomatic niceties were maintained. Sir Neville Henderson did not fail to note in his dispatch that night, describing the meeting, that Ribbentrop had been courteous and polite. As the ambassador prepared to take his leave, an argument arose as to whether the German foreign minister had gabbled the text of the German proposals to Poland at their stormy meeting two evenings before. Henderson said he had. Ribbentrop said he had read them slowly and clearly, and even given oral explanations of the main points, so that he could suppose Henderson had understood everything. It was an argument that would never be settled, but what difference did it make now? On the night of September 1st, as the German armies penetrated further into Poland and the Luftwaffe bombed and bombed, Hitler knew from the Anglo-French notes that unless he stopped his armies and quickly withdrew them, which was unthinkable, he had a world war on his hands. Or did he still hope that night that his luck, his Munich luck, might hold? For his friend Mussolini, frightened by the advent of war and fearing that an overwhelming Anglo-French naval and military force might strike against Italy, was desperately trying to arrange another Munich. The last-minute intervention of Mussolini. As late as August 26th, it will be remembered, the Duce, in ducking out of Italy's obligation under the Pact of Steel, had insisted to the Führer that there was still a possibility of a political solution which would give full moral and material satisfaction to Germany. Hitler had not bothered to argue the matter with his friend and ally, and this had discouraged the junior partner in the Axis. Nevertheless, on August 31st, as we have seen, Mussolini and Ciano, after being advised by their ambassador in Berlin that the situation had become desperate, had urged Hitler at least to see the Polish ambassador, Lipski, and had informed him that they were trying to get the British government to agree to the return of Danzig as a first step in peace negotiations. But it was too late for Hitler to be tempted by such small bait. Danzig was a mere pretense, as the Führer had told his generals. What he wanted was to destroy Poland. But the Duce did not know this. On the morning of September 1st, he himself was confronted with the choice of immediately declaring Italy's neutrality or risking an attack by Britain and France. Ciano's diary entries make clear what a nightmare this prospect was for his deflated father-in-law. Actually, Mussolini's decision was conveyed to Britain the night before. At 11:15 p.m. on August 31st, the Foreign Office received a message from Sir Percy Lorraine in Rome. Decision of the Italian government is taken. Italy will not fight against either England or France. This communication made to me by Ciano at 21:15, 9:15 p.m., under seal of secrecy. That evening, the Italians had been given a scare by the British cutting off all telephone communication with Rome after 8 p.m. Ciano feared it might be the prelude to an Anglo-French attack. Early on the morning of September 1st, the unhappy Italian dictator personally telephoned Ambassador Attolico in Berlin and, in the words of Ciano, urged him to entreat Hitler to send him a telegram releasing him from the obligations of the alliance. The Führer quickly and even graciously obliged. Just before he left for the Reichstag at 9:40 a.m., he got off a telegram to his friend, which was telephoned through to the German embassy in Rome to save time. Duce, I thank you most cordially for the diplomatic and political support which you have been giving recently to Germany and her just cause. I am convinced that we can carry out the task imposed on us with the military forces of Germany. I do not therefore expect to need Italy's military support in these circumstances. I also thank you, Duce, for everything which you will do in future for the common cause of fascism and National Socialism. Adolf Hitler. At 4:30 p.m., following a meeting of the Council of Ministers in Rome, the Italian radio broadcast the Council's announcement to the Italian people that Italy will take no initiative in the way of military operations. Immediately afterward, Hitler's message to Mussolini releasing Italy from its obligations was broadcast. At 12:45 p.m., after having addressed the Reichstag and after having, apparently, recovered from the effects of his outburst to Dolores, Hitler was moved to send a further message to Mussolini, declaring that he had been prepared to solve the Polish problem by negotiation, and that for two whole days I have waited in vain for a Polish negotiator, and that last night alone there were 14 more cases of frontier violation, and that consequently he had now decided to answer force with force. He again expressed his gratitude to his Welshing partner. I thank you, Duce, for all your efforts. I thank you in particular also for your offers of mediation. But from the start I was skeptical about these attempts, because the Polish government, if they had had even the slightest intention of solving the matter amicably, could have done so at any time, but they refused. For this reason, Duce, I did not want to expose you to the danger of assuming the role of mediator, which, in view of the Polish government's intransigent attitude, would in all possibility have been in vain. Adolf Hitler. But Mussolini, prompted by Ciano, made one last desperate effort to expose himself to the danger of being a mediator. Already on the previous day, shortly after noon, Ciano had proposed to the British and French ambassadors in Rome that, if their governments agreed, Mussolini would invite Germany to a conference on September 5th for the purpose of examining the clauses of the Treaty of Versailles which are the cause of the present troubles. It might have been thought that the news of the German invasion of Poland the next morning would have rendered Mussolini's proposal superfluous, but the Italians' surprise, Georges Bonnet, the French foreign minister and master appeaser, telephoned François Poncet, who was now the ambassador of France in Rome, at 11:45 a.m. on September 1st, and asked him to tell Ciano that the French government welcomed such a conference, provided that it did not try to deal with problems of countries not represented, and that it did not restrict itself to seeking partial and provisional solutions for limited and immediate problems. Bonnet made no mention of any withdrawal of German troops or even of their halting as a condition for such a conference. Twice during the afternoon of September 1st, Bonnet instructed Noel, the French ambassador in Warsaw, to ask Beck if Poland would accept the Italian proposal for a conference. Later that evening, he received his reply. We are in the midst of war as the result of unprovoked aggression. It is no longer a question of a conference, but of common action which the Allies should take to resist. Bonnet's messages and Beck's reply are in the French Yellow Book. The British government did not associate itself with Bonnet's efforts. A Foreign Office memorandum signed by R.M. Makins notes that the British government was neither consulted nor informed of this démarche. But the British were insistent upon that condition and succeeded in carrying the badly divided French cabinet along with them so that identical warning notes could be delivered in Berlin on the evening of September 1st. Since the text of those notes, giving notice that Britain and France would go to war unless the German troops were withdrawn from Poland, was made public the same evening, it is interesting that Mussolini, now clutching desperately at every straw, or even at straws which were not there, went ahead the next morning in a further appeal to Hitler, just as if he, the Duce, did not take the Anglo-French warnings at face value. September 2nd, as Henderson noted in his final report, was a day of suspense. The previous afternoon, on instructions from Halifax, Henderson had burned his ciphers and confidential documents and officially requested the United States chargé d'affaires to be good enough to take charge of British interests in the event of war. British Blue Book, page 21. He and Coulondre waited anxiously for Hitler's reply to their notes, but none came. Shortly after midday, Atolico, somewhat out of breath, arrived at the British embassy and told Henderson he must know one thing immediately. Was the British note of the previous evening an ultimatum or not? I told him, Henderson later wrote, that I had been authorized to tell the Minister of Foreign Affairs, if he had asked me, which he had not done, that it was not an ultimatum but a warning. Having received his answer, the Italian ambassador hastened down the Wilhelmstrasse to the German Foreign Office. Atolico had arrived at 10 o'clock that morning at the Wilhelmstrasse with a communication from Mussolini, and, being told that Ribbentrop was unwell, handed it to Weizsäcker. September 2, 1939. For purposes of information, Italy wishes to make known, naturally leaving any decision to the Führer, that she still has the possibility of getting France, Britain, and Poland to agree to a conference on the following bases. 1. An armistice, which leaves the armies where they are now. 2. Convening of the conference within 2 to 3 days. 3. Settlement of the Polish-German dispute, which, as matters stand today, would certainly be favorable to Germany. The idea, which originally emanated from the Duce, is now supported particularly by France. Ciano claims that the note was sent as the result of French pressure, Ciano Diaries, page 136. But this is surely misleading. Though Bonnet was doing all he could to get a conference, Mussolini was pushing the proposal even more desperately. Danzig is already German, and Germany has already in her hands pledges which guarantee her the greater part of her claims. Moreover, Germany has already had her moral satisfaction. If she accepted the proposal for a conference, she would achieve all her aims and at the same time avoid a war, which even now looks like becoming general and of extremely long duration. The Duce does not want to insist, but it is of the greatest moment to him that the above should be immediately brought to the attention of Herr von Ribbentrop and the Führer. No wonder that when Ribbentrop, who had quickly recovered from his indisposition, saw Atolico at 12:30 p.m., he pointed out that the Duce's proposal could not be reconciled with the Anglo-French notes of the evening before, which had the character of an ultimatum. The Italian ambassador, who was as anxious as his chief to avoid a world war and certainly more sincere, interrupted Ribbentrop to say that the British and French declarations had been superseded by the latest communication from the Duce. Atolico, of course, had no authority whatsoever to make such a statement, which was not true, but at this late hour he probably thought he could lose nothing by being reckless. When the German foreign minister expressed his doubts, Atolico stuck to his view. The French and British declarations, he said, no longer came into consideration. Count Ciano had telephoned only at 8:30 this morning, that is to say at a time when the declarations had already been given out on the radio in Italy. It followed that the two declarations must be considered as superseded. Count Ciano stated, moreover, that France in particular was greatly in favor of the Duce's proposal. The pressure comes at the moment from France, but England will follow. Ribbentrop remained skeptical. He had just discussed Mussolini's proposal with Hitler, he said, and what the Führer wanted to know was, were the Anglo-French notes ultimata? The foreign minister finally agreed to Atolico's suggestion that the Italian envoy should immediately consult Henderson and Coulondre to find out. That was the reason for Atolico's call at the British Embassy. I can still see Atolico, no longer in his first youth, Schmidt, who acted as interpreter, wrote later, running out of Ribbentrop's room and down the steps to consult Henderson and Coulondre. A half hour later, Atolico came running back, as breathless as he had left. Regaining his breath, the Italian ambassador reported that Henderson had just told him the British note was not an ultimatum. Ribbentrop replied that while a German reply to the Anglo-French declarations could only be negative, the Führer was examining the Duce's proposals, and if Rome confirmed that there had been no question of an ultimatum in the Anglo-French declaration, would draft an answer in a day or two. When Attolico pressed for an earlier answer, Ribbentrop finally agreed to reply by noon the next day, Sunday, September 3rd.